Hi everyone, and welcome to the EdTech podcast in Takeover This Week with Bo Clips. This week we're talking about video in education, teaching and learning. There's no doubt about the power of video to engage us and communicate new ideas. TED content receives 3.2 billion views a year, and TED's youth and education initiative, TED-Ed, grew 47% year over year in 2017 to 2018. Oh, and by the way, you can check out our interview with Alex Rosenthal, editorial producer of TED-Ed from last year in episode 70. Over on YouTube, the EDU aspect of YouTube is going great guns, hosting original content and making education and edtech stars from the likes of Colin Hegarty, Diana Cowan and Salman Khan, to name but a few. In fact, Khan Academy has more than 62 million registered users. And if none of these names ring a bell, I bet once upon a time you hung out with Big Bird to either learn your ABCs or help impart that knowledge to someone else. But outside of the numbers, what are the claims of video for helping to support learning? Namely, engaging students in a medium they are familiar with and excited by.
I mean, there have been quite a few research pieces done around really the engagement that video delivers over just text and still images. And I think, you know, there's a thing from Forrester that says 3 minutes of video is worth a million words. Who knows whether that is or isn't sort of correct. But the bottom line is that students, and indeed teachers, outside of the classroom, are part of a Netflix generation. They consume video, they share information, their own information through video, like on Facebook Live. It's become sort of part of the social fabric. And they expect the same thing in the classroom. And I think it's more around, if you don't use video, you really are missing out on a tool to help with that engagement in the classroom.
Opening up access to expertise.
I have a biochemistry degree, and John studied a lot of things, religion and literature. And so from, you know, the lens of people who are kind of overeducated YouTubers, older, you know, than the average YouTube creator, you know, I made a video about the circulatory system because I didn't know what else to do that day.
And creating a community of peer-to-peer learning.
Video online was no longer a one-way street. It was more of a conversation. There were communities building up around this content. People saying, oh, I am so afraid to swim myself. How did you get started? And someone replying to that comment saying, oh, stick at it, you'll be great. And there was this entire community that built around the video, and that really opened my eyes to the power of online video to create community and to facilitate learning.
Let's find out more. Cool. So today we are in conversation with the CEO of Basho & Friends, Basho Moscow.
Hi.
Hello. And then before we start, here's a bit about Basho. So Basho holds a Master in International Affairs degree from Columbia University and a bilingual teaching credential. He has worked with children in Guatemala, Ethiopia and throughout the US and has over 20 years of teaching experience. You might like to know that Basho composed music for Sesame Street in addition to his YouTube channel, which has more than 21 million views, promoting language learning across Spanish, English and Mandarin, to name but a few. So welcome, Basho Moscow.
Thank you, Sophie.
So the first question, Basho, you've been teaching for over 20 years and more recently your YouTube videos for language learning have had thousands and thousands of views each. So what's your opinion on video's place in teaching and learning?
First of all, I want to thank you for having me on the program. I'm really excited to be chatting with you. And in terms of video's place in teaching and learning, I do feel like it's opened up the world to accessing specialists, people that are extremely good at something that they may do that before the video being introduced into education was inaccessible. You have a teacher in a small town who may be asked to teach multiple subjects. And it's impossible to be a content expert at multiple subjects. And I would argue that it's unrealistic to even ask an individual to become a content expert in multiple subjects. It's not effective. that person can practice building relationships with their students and really coaching them on being great people and how to learn. So video, it opens up a door for those specialists to come in and present the content in a way that is digestible, compelling, and may reach kids in a way that a teacher wouldn't be able to reach the kids.
I mean, and how did you get into all of this? And I suppose a follow-on from the last question would be, I imagine that given the number of views that you have, you get a wealth of feedback in terms of how teachers and learners are using the videos and what impact they may have as well. So just wondered if you could share some of that with our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, how I got into it, it really started when I was in graduate school at Columbia. I produced a documentary about an adult learn to swim class at Columbia. And it was a topic that I thought was interesting and relatable. And this was early, early YouTube days, and put it up on YouTube. And within about 6 months, it had, 250,000 views. And there was a lot of dialogue happening on the video. And I think for me, it was a real aha around this idea that video online was no longer a one-way street. It was more of a conversation. There were communities building up around this content. People saying, oh, I am so afraid to swim myself. How did you get started? And someone replying to that comment saying, oh, stick at it, you'll be great. And there was this entire community that built around the video, and that really opened my eyes to the power of online video to create community and to facilitate learning. And then in 2008, I started putting content online. I was working with a language company called Lango at the time, producing music for their sort of mommy and me toddler language classes in Spanish. And once those songs went online, the response was outrageous. Teachers loved it. They were hungry, hungry for musical content that would make the learning a little bit more fun and engage their kids in a way that they did, maybe didn't have the experience or the skills or the interest in doing. So that's how I got started.
And how about the feedback on teachers and learners and how they're sort of going about using the videos as well?
Well, I think the feedback has been overwhelmingly great. I think when you get to YouTube, people are very feel very free to comment on the quality that they think it is or isn't and any mistakes that you've made. So I would say as a crowdsourcing resource for grammar, punctuation mistakes, it's been extraordinary. But in terms of use in the classroom, we've had, I think we're at over 22 million views now. We're in countries throughout the world. And teachers are, I think that the biggest comment that we get is from the teacher side, it's so great to have high quality content that my kids really love, that they're really engaged in, and it makes the learning fun and it gives us an entree into the actual content. And from kids, I get a lot of middle school and high school students saying, this stuff is lit. This is my beat. This is my jam. I want, this is my ringtone. And I think it provides that other end of, high school, middle school language content isn't generally presented in a way that people wouldn't necessarily say is super dynamic or fun. And so by adding music and animated graphics to it, I think we add a new element that makes it more interesting.
Okay, so today we are with Hank Green from the Vlog Brothers. And Hank, if I've done my homework right, you've been vlogging on YouTube since 2007. And you create content on everything from science to politics to philosophy with a very hefty following. So my first question for this episode really is, what's the power of video for education, teaching and learning as you see it?
So we've always imagined it in a pretty specific way. Like our job is to try and get across information in the way that works best for sort of the lean forward experience of online video, which is a very, very different experience from, like, if you're watching a documentary film, for example. You would want that information to sort of come at you slowly and be, the kind of thing where, you can pause and restart and be eating dinner and all of that, like TV style consumption. But what if we create content that's really designed and from the place of how people create for online video, which is very like, you've got 800 different things demanding your time. There's a cat video right over there in the sidebar, and there's emails that need to be answered, and Twitter has everything both beautiful and terrible that you could ever be sucked into enjoying or being scared by. So how are we going to keep people watching, and how are we going to fit like all of the information that we can so that people's brains are very active and engaged without being so overwhelming that people can't actually learn? And part of that is also understanding that with a video like this, it's completely normal for someone to pause, to go back, to rewatch a section, to skip a section, because that is how more and more people are able to interact with online video. In fact, lots of keyboard and smartphone shortcuts allow you to skip back 30 seconds or, you know, watch a certain portion of the video in 2x speed. So with the knowledge that people can use all of those tools to try and create content that really gets, you know, a little bit of the context around education, a little bit of a story around it, and tell it in a way that could potentially be a video that someone would want not just to watch, to learn and revise, but also maybe they'd want to share it with a friend. Maybe they just watch it for fun. And we do see huge spikes right before the American AP tests. So those tests all happen at the same time all over the country. And we can see the 2 weeks before, you start to see a little bump. A week before, it's maybe a little bit higher. And then the 3 days before the AP test in any given subject, it's 10 times the average viewership on that course. So that is how we study.
It's a little bit of panic in there by that point.
Yeah.
I mean, how has your content sort of developed since the early days and I guess the more educational focused stuff now? So thinking about Crash Course and Science Show or SciShow. And so then you've gone on to, you know, almost become like a serial entrepreneur, but using new media. So how do you think that's come about?
Just completely by accident. I mean, John and I started uploading these videos about education and they did so, like, in addition to being harder to produce and longer to produce, they just did really well. But it felt like something we couldn't do all the time because it was just hard. It was time consuming and we didn't have the resources to like level them up or produce them regularly. And so luckily Google came in and was like, what would you do if we gave you $500,000 basically? And we were like, well, I think start some educational YouTube shows. And they said, okay. And they gave us money and we started up Crash Course and SciShow. Like none of this would exist without that, the faith that they put in us and the money that they put into us. So I'm super thankful for that. And I think that money has come back manyfold. Maybe not in advertising revenue to YouTube. Maybe it's earned out. Yeah, I mean, it has at this point. But I think that in terms of the value it's provided for society, it's come back manyfold, I like to think.
And what would you like to see next for, like, video in education or for your own projects in that space?
I think that we always need to be looking at how kids currently consume content. And so it's got to feel comfortable, like something that they would normally consume, to sort of like have the look and feel without obviously being, you know, like trying to pander to, you know, like a good old hip hop song about chemistry or something. Though occasionally I'm a big fan of a hip hop song about chemistry, let's be honest. The things that have been doing really well are, that I think young people get pretty excited about. Are information dense. They are, like, I think that we need to, like, give kids credit, young people credit, for consuming content that is interesting and does help them understand the world, as long as you can pitch it in a way that, like, is a story that would interest them.
The learner communities growing around these online video sites is really interesting, and peer-to-peer learning through video engagement is worth a further look. First up, as well as adult YouTube educators, there's a whole community of so-called study tubers like Jade Bowler of YouTube channel Unjaded Jade, a revision and productivity site which has had over 10 million views. A recent four-month study between A Tale Unfolds and researchers with UCL's Institute of Education also showed that by using video as a stimulus and output with their particular tool, designed to improve student literacy by using digital video as an engagement tool, traditional English progress was improved by 3.75 times the national average rate, or, put another way, there was 15 months of progress in just 4 months. Link for that in the show notes. And remember that video binge-watching session that Hank mentioned? Well, a 2017 Khan Academy announcement showed that studying for the SAT test for 20 hours on Khan Academy's free official SAT practice was associated with an average score gain of 115 points, nearly double that of students who didn't use the test prep at all. But what's the previous teacher's take on it all?
My name is Bethany Boudry, and I work with BoClips as the Director of Community Management.
And in a previous life, you were a teacher, is that correct?
Absolutely. In a previous life, I was a teacher. I taught for about 10 years in the state of Michigan.
Okay, fantastic. And what age group were your students?
The bulk of my teaching experience was with fourth graders, but I also spent a little time in middle school with seventh graders and in a technology specialist position.
And to what extent was video used within the environment around you, either in your own class or among some of your colleagues? And what were the kind of restrictions, if you experienced any?
Absolutely. A video was used fairly regularly in the classroom as a way to supplement the curriculum or to add into the curriculum where we could and kind of enrich the experience with that. It came in all sorts of forms. We would, of course, use YouTube. My school, I was fortunate enough to have access to YouTube, but since leaving the classroom, I have had the opportunity to work with several schools that have experienced that firewall issue. And how do you deal with the workaround? In the classroom, it was used whenever we could as an engaging point, whether it was a longer video to go over a topic or a shorter video to go over a topic.
And how did you also see students using videos?
Absolutely. So I went through quite a change with video in the classroom from the beginning of my career until I left. But toward the end, I was working in a one-to-one environment. So each of my students had their own laptops, and we relied heavily on our learning management system for the one-to-one program. So I was able to share video links through our learning management system for them to watch using a flipped classroom approach, or for them to watch in small group activities through a blended learning approach. And that was a really nice resource that I can see BoClips will tie into lovely with using it for flipped classroom, for blended learning, or even for virtual learning.
But what are the current obstacles for using video in institutional settings, and whose responsibility is it to overcome these? The teacher, the learner, the content producer, or someone else?
You know, the educational landscape, it's a very complex and complicated path.
For us, it isn't so much how do we figure out how to get this in a classroom, how do we figure out how to integrate it with existing educational systems. For us, that's the teacher's job, and we want to provide the thing that works for students, and how it gets used, how it gets studied, whether or not, like, it's all ultimately down to we're going to provide this for free, and if you want to use it in your classroom, you decide how that's going to be used. You can assign it as a homework thing. You can watch at the beginning of class and then discuss it. It's all down to how the teacher wants to do it. We're just trying to create a good product.
There seems to be a tension between appropriate content and context, avoiding distraction, and walking the line between engagement and meeting the needs of the curriculums you serve as soon as you cross into schools.
I've had teachers say, like, I can't show a video that's going to have an advertisement before it if I don't know what that advertisement's going to be. Like, if it's, like, suddenly, you know, the whole school, like, the whole room is in uproar because, you know, I was logged into my YouTube account and it showed an ad for, like, Hendrix, you know, and we don't want to be showing kids advertisements for gin. So that's a problem. It could also be like a perfectly suitable advertisement for children, but you still don't want to show kids advertisements in schools because that's weird. There are ways to turn off ads on YouTube. They cost money and they're not available in all countries. So that's not great. And then you, of course, have, you know, if you're assigning it to a student, you're going to have 1,000 distractions. And it's not just like bad videos. It's also as a learner, you want to be focused on one thing. You don't want to be thinking, well, maybe this video over here is going to teach to me better, so I'll stop the video I'm currently watching and go watch this other video. And then I'm like, well, this one isn't working either, so I'll try another one. And it just, like, you can get into sort of a rabbit hole, and eventually, like, it's not too many steps before you're actually watching something that maybe is peripherally tied to the subject you should be learning, but is much more sort of entertaining and less focused on, you know, how what you're going to need to do well in your course. Obviously, like, this, like, we never consider Crash Course a replacement for you know, like, an actual course, because it's a 10-minute lecture. But we also try and get as you know, as much good information in there as we can. And there's always a fight between, like, how do you, like, how many words are we going to spend on the context and on the arc of the episode, and how many words are we going to spend on the, you know, the content, the stuff that you need to be learning. And of course, those two things I think are the same. But when you have a syllabus and it's like, we have to get to all these points in the syllabus, suddenly, you know, like, our writing staff is always sort of in a fight over, you know, do we cut out this, just like cut this whole section out of the syllabus and say, like, well, the teacher's going to get there if they want to, or do we try and pack it full so that it, and then you end up with kind of an episode that's just like a list of things you need to know, which is very, like, something we try to avoid.
I think my next move is to move into curriculum. I think teachers are delighted to be able to find my content on YouTube and use a video here and there, but in some places YouTube is blocked or they can't download it locally and they're looking for activities to go along. So for me, I think at the end of May, early June, I'll be launching a sort of bundle that will allow people to, you know, purchase a Spanish 1 kit, and that will be our MVP in terms of how can we roll out language learning in a sort of contained environment that's full of music and videos and engaging activities to do with your adult friends, and it's a lot of fun.
And then, of course, there's the firewall issue.
One of the data points that we've been given here this week is that 70% of US schools don't accept YouTube through the firewall.
BoClips aggregates over 3 million rights-ready video clips onto a single cloud-based platform. Basho and Hank are among just some of the EDU YouTubers to join BoClips, along with TED-Ed as part of a wider YouTube EDU initiative. I spoke to their founder, David Bainbridge, and Bethany Beaudry, Director of Global Community Management at BoClips.
My name is David Bainbridge. I'm the CEO and founder of BoClips. BoClips is a video platform that has been specifically created for the education community, for publishers, education providers, teachers and students. It brings together over 3 million video clips, so snackable content from around the world, from famous brands that you'll know and love, like TED Talks and TED-Ed and Reuters and Bloomberg, all the way through to quite niche providers of video content that's very apposite for the education marketplace. We're 4 years old, and we are delighted to be announcing here at South by Southwest that for the first time our platform, which up until now has been made available for instructional designers, is being opened up to teachers directly. So we're very excited to get feedback from the many teachers that there are here over the last couple of days. You know, the problem that we're trying to crack is when it comes to either instructional designers or teachers looking for content and using video content, it's kind of challenging. There are all sorts of issues around discovery. If you're looking to use Felix Baumgartner jumping out the Red Bull balloon from space to illustrate terminal velocity, who do you go to get hold of that particular clip? Do you go to the news provider? Do you go to Red Bull? Do you go to Felix Baumgartner's agent? It's not very clear. So there's a sort of discovery piece, there's a rights piece. Are those rights cleared for the education market? They might be cleared for program making or advertising, but not necessarily for education. And then the economics. How do instructional designers and teachers pay for copyrighted material to use in instructional materials and in the classroom, but without it kind of breaking the bank? They don't have the budgets of brands.
And I mean, that's an interesting point. I don't know if you've, I mean, you must have experienced this, but is there a kind of difference between how to get BoQuips, or whether it's BoQuips or anyone else, the video into students' hands? Is it a case of, you know, going to sort of the district level? Is it a case of engaging with individual teachers? What's kind of worked the best?
So I think we are looking at all of those options, Sophie. So I think ensuring that we are, as a business and as the product is getting first-hand feedback from teachers, that's helping us refine and develop it over time is critical. So we're absolutely looking to seed the product with teachers directly, and that's part of the reason why we're here and why Bethany's come on board to help us do that. But also, you know, a key part of our go-to-market strategy is not to do it alone. It's to take the product that we have and to work with channel partners who see the value proposition that we're providing teachers, and they're bundling that into their existing services. So, you know, a key pain point I think for teachers would be, you know, here's another service in the schoolroom, in the classroom. I have to understand that user experience. That's a pain for me. I don't want to do that. I want single sign-on. But if I can come into my LMS and it's all available, it might not even be branded BoQuips. It might be just powered by BoQuips. It's really easy to just use with my existing workflows. That's the perfect model. But it doesn't mean that we won't be still working directly with teachers. That's very, very important as well. The US obviously is a key market. It's a third of the world's educational spend is here. So as a British company, you know, we definitely look to the West. But we also look to the East because, of, again, all the things we know, there's an emerging middle class there that needs to be able, the children at least need to have an attainment in English to get into university. And the fact that, just again, here at South by Southwest, we've announced our partnership with YouTube that sees the very best education channels like TED Talks and TED-Ed also available on BoQuips. That is a real distribution nut that we've cracked for those educational channels, because YouTube is not allowed through the Chinese firewall. So we provide the key for those education channels into that market for the first time. And there are some big guys over there, you know, the Baidus, the Alibaba and Tencents. They've got big video plays already. They see providing educational content as being a key part of their content strategies moving forwards. So, you know, it doesn't happen overnight, but there are, you know, we're having some very interesting conversations about their ambition using English language educational content from the West.
What's your favourite BoQuip, and who are you most excited about working with?
Oh my goodness me. My favourite BoQuip is probably just the latest nonsense from Donald Trump yesterday that we will have on the platform today, talking about, I don't know, the steel tariffs or whatever it might be. I think there's the thing that's wonderful about our library is that it's yesterday's content, but it's also the fact that you can see all the primary news coverage from, like, I mean, I read American studies for my sins at university, so the Vietnam War in black and white at your fingertips, from the Tet Offensive through to, you know, interviews with Ho Chi Minh and all that sort of thing, all the way back to Buffalo Bill in 1900. So the library goes back to the first ever video that was made. We have it on the platform.
So there you have it, a quick review of the power of video in education. Before we go, here are some top inspirational video and content tips from our guests.
Yeah, I mean, I there are tons of educational YouTube creators. In fact, it's like one of the fastest growing and most interesting places on the site. And it seems to happen in these spurts where groups will sort of rise up together. They'll find a new thing that works really well and they'll all do that. There's like a show called Wendover Productions. It focuses on like international logistics, but for some reason is extremely interesting to watch. It's just like, yeah, how does a package get from my house to your house in one day? How is that possible? Yeah, you wouldn't think that would be that interesting of a video, but like it sure does have 2 million views on YouTube. There's a channel called Real Engineering that sort of rose along with them. Physics Girl is one of my favorites right now. Diana's great and doing lots of interesting things, and I've been really excited to watch her channel grow and have more opportunities coming her way. Vanessa from Braincraft is doing really interesting things. you know, and there's also like institutions that have gotten into this mix. Like news is being done in more interesting ways, and I can see that being used in international studies classes, civics classes. And like Vox, I think Vox is really smart in how they cover things. And in though they like in their editorial page definitely are liberal leaning, I think in a lot of their video stuff, it's very sort of just like, here's the situation. No judgment, no idea about what to do about it. Like just want to understand what the situation is. And in the same, like in a sort of different way, the Field Museum in Chicago has the Brain Scoop, which is a show that actually like we started up a long time ago, and then it went over to become part of the Field Museum, which is a, you know, like let's learn about biology, but and natural history, but through the lens of this massive institution with this massive collection and lots of science happening inside of this building. Where usually we just think of it as like what's on display, but also institution museums are very like active scientific institutions as well.
As a teacher and moving into the world of educational technology, there are several people that I look to kind of as mentors in my PLN or my personal learning network. So Kevin Honeycutt is one of them, and Mark Prinsky is another that I can think of off the top of my head. And you mentioned books. So two recent ones that I've really enjoyed in working with teachers are Start With Why by Simon Sinek. I've found a lot of teachers really enjoy reading that book to the point that I've had conversations at the booth where they go, well, what's the why behind bow clips? What's the purpose and intent behind this? Yes. Why are you doing this? Is it just for blah, blah, blah? And another one is Mindset by Carol Dweck. And her work, as you probably know, is very big in education right now with the fixed mindset and growth mindset. So it's fascinating reading that and watching my own children learn about mindset in their own school.
The YouTube education community is a really tight-knit group, and there's extremely talented people within that. I would say Hank and John Green, the Vlog Brothers, have been doing it maybe the longest and present a very strong face for equity in education and providing great quality content that's vetted for everybody. And they have Crash Course Kids and SciShow Kids. Khan Academy is amazing. I have some friends at Alphabet Rockers. They do sort of hip-hop music that teaches equity lessons and about diversity and culture. But I, you know, I would say if there was a book or resource that I could come back to, I was just thinking about this the other day, and it might sort of come out of left field a bit, but the autobiography of Malcolm X is one that I always come back to. And I think that what I love about that book and about his story is that he wasn't afraid to be big throughout, and that he made huge mistakes and then owned his mistakes and then changed and evolved as his life went on. And it allowed him to be this charismatic leader. And I see that as a real asset on YouTube these days, the charismatic folks that are willing to be vulnerable and make mistakes and be honest about it and share their full spectrum of both strengths and weaknesses, vulnerability and emotions. I feel like there's a level of authenticity in content that is, it's a real asset. And so that's kind of what I aspire to going forth.
That's all for this week. Thanks for listening in. I'd love to hear your stories on learning through video. Please do share them via Twitter or speakpipe.com/theedtechpodcast. Have you learned a huge amount from video? What are your favourite video sites or YouTube channels to learn from? What content do you like to use in schools or unis? And can there ever be enough Donald Trump news footage? All this and more, send it across at podcastedtech or at bowclips. For all the projects and links mentioned in the show, please go to the podcast website at www.theedtechpodcast.com. For everything Bowclips, check out their video library for education at bowclips.com. Simples. Thanks to all my guests this week, Basho Moscow, Hank Green, Bethany Beaudry, and David Bainbridge. Wherever you're listening in today, goodbye.